When film director John Huston died 2 years ago, he left behind a legacy of classic films such as The Maltese Falcon, The African Queen, Key Largo, The Asphalt Jungle, and The Misfits. Pritzi's Honor and The Dead were among his last films. They both starred his daughter Angelica. John Huston directed his father Walter in the 1948 film Treasure of the Sierra Madre. The Huston family is the subject of a new biography by Lawrence Grobel, who's best known for his Playboy magazine interviews. In fact, Grobel interviewed John Huston for Playboy in 1984, 2 years before beginning his book, The Hustons. Grobel spent 100 hours with Huston and was on the set during the shooting of The Dead. Grobel also interviewed Huston's children, several of his ex-wives, and many actors who were directed by him, including Katharine Hepburn. John Huston got his start writing screenplays. When Warner Brothers offered him the chance to direct a film, he chose to adapt Dashiell Hammett's book, The Maltese Falcon.
The book always interested him. He liked Dashiell Hammett. He liked the writing. He liked the idea. He thought that he could handle this kind of a film. One of the things also about that film was that the studio, Warner Brothers, owned The Maltese Falcon, because they had shot it twice before, earlier, and neither one really worked. So they were kind of happy, in a sense, that they could get, that John wanted to do this one, because they had it, they didn't have to buy it again, and they thought they could give him a shot at it. George Raft, who was originally going to star in it, didn't want to do it, because he said, I don't want to work with a first-time director. So he dropped out, and that's when John was pleased, because he got to get Bogart, and then he got to cast Sidney Greenstreet, who had never acted in a film before. You know, he knew what he wanted. He had Peter Lorre, and of course, Mary Astor. And he put that together. And I think John's genius was in his casting. He knew how to create the actors and to match them to the parts. And that way he could sort of leave them alone.
Well, you have a story about the very last line of this film. And I thought I'd play the scene, the very end scene, and then ask you about the story of the last line. And this is after Bogart's kind of solved the mystery of the Maltese Falcon. The cops come, and they're wondering what was the Maltese Falcon really made of, and why was there such lusting after it.
Come in. Hello, Tom. Got him?
Got him.
Swell. Here's another one for you. She killed Miles. Oh, and I've got some exhibits. The boy's guns, one of Cairo's, and $1,000 bill I was supposed to be bribed with. And this black statuette here that all the fuss was about.
Harry, what is it?
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Huh?
What is it? The stuff that dreams are made of. What's the story behind those last words of the film?
Well, that was not in Dashiell Hammett's book, and John was credited with the screenplay, and until really just recently, everyone thought that he wrote those lines. And it's maybe the most famous lines in any of his films, along with badges. We don't have to use. We don't need no stinking badges from Treasure. But he told me when we were talking about this film, just right before he died, he said, "You know, this will be in a way of a revelation, Larry." He says, "But the last line to the Maltese Falcon," he says, "I didn't do it." He said, "What happened is the day they were going to shoot that scene, Bogart came up to him and said, John." I have an idea. And he says, what do you think if I say this, the stuff the dreams are made of? You think that's any good, John? And John said, I think it's very good, Bogey, very good indeed. Indeed it was.
My guest is Lawrence Grobel, and he's the author of the new book, The Hustons, which is a biography of film director and writer John Huston, his father, the actor Walter Huston, and John Huston's daughter, the actress Angelica Huston. Now, John Huston directed his father, Walter Huston, in the film, the 1948 film, Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Right.
Let's listen to a scene with his father in it, then you could tell us how they came to make this movie together. And this is a scene about gold and greed.
You know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking we ought to give up. Leave the whole outfit.
everything behind and go back to civilization.
What's that you say? Go back? Well, tell my old grandmother. I got two very elegant bedfellows who kick at the first drop of rain and hide in the closet from thunder rumbles. My, what great prospectors. Two shoe clerks reading the magazine about prospecting for gold in the land of the midnight sun, south of the border, west of the Rockies.
That's your trap. Shut up, Ross. Smash your head flat.
Go ahead. Throw it. If you did, you'd never leave this wilderness alive. Without me, you two would die here more miserable than rats.
I'll leave him alone.
Can't you see the old man's nuts?
Nuts! Nuts, am I? Let me tell you something, my two fine bedfellows. You're so dumb, there's nothing to compare you with. You're dumber than the dumbest jackass. Look at each other, will you? Do you ever see anything like yourself for being dumb specimens? You're so dumb, you don't even see the riches you're treading on with your own feet. Yeah, don't expect to find nuggets of molten gold. It's rich, but not that rich. And here ain't the place to dig. It comes from someplace further up. Up there. Up there's where we got to go. Up there.
A scene from Treasure of the Sierra Madre, and I should mention that John Huston won two Academy Awards for that, both for Best Direction and Best Screenplay, and his father, Walter Huston, who played the old-timer, won as Best Supporting Actor. How did they get to work together, the two Hustons, on that film?
Well, Walter, who was already a very big star by then, always said to John, "Find me a part for your old man. You know, find me a good part." And so he was always looking, John, and he always wanted to do this film. And when he got in touch with B. Travin and said that he wanted to cast through letters, this is Walter in this, he said, "No, Walter's not old enough." He wanted Lewis Calhern, but John then got Walter. He says, "Well, I can make him work," and that's why he got Walter to take out his teeth, which Louis B. Mayer said was never able to forgive John for. He says, "How could you do that to your father, make him take his teeth out?" But of course, that helped.
When you say teeth, were they dentures, or did he have them surgically removed?
Right. Okay. At that particular scene, which is a very famous scene, John didn't know he was going to do that. Walter had said to him, "Listen, just let the cameras roll. I've got an idea, and don't call cut." So he does this jig, a jig that he learned from Eugene O'Neill in Desire Under the Elms. He does that maniacal laugh and that speedy talk, which he learned from his sister Margaret, who really taught Walter how to play a lot of these parts, especially early in his career. And he did this scene, and Bogart was off to the side, and he watched it, and he was saying, he mumbled something to the effect that working with one Huston is bad enough, working with two is murder, because he saw right there that Walter Huston just stole the film from him, and was going to make it memorable, and he did.
Well, moving along in John Huston's career, let's talk about the 1948 film Key Largo. And this is a film about a gangster holding people captive in a Florida hotel. I want to play what's really... It's probably one of the most famous scenes from the film. It's my favorite scene from the film. And this is where Edward G. Robinson and Claire Trevor are in this scene. She's an alcoholic, and she's begging him for a drink. And he says, "Well, sing, moan and low. Sing a song, and he'll give her the drink." And he wants her to sing the song that she used to always sing when she was a nightclub singer. So this is the scene where she sings that song.
Well, go ahead, sing.
Moaning low, my sweet man is gonna go. When he goes, oh Lordy, he's the kind of man needs the kind of woman like me.
Give me that drink now, Johnny.
No.
Johnny.
No.
But you promised.
So what?
You said that...
But you were right.
No.
Cruel and humiliating. Well, there's an interesting story behind how John Huston directed Claire Trevor in that scene.
Yes, I saw Claire Trevor in New York, and she told me that She was very afraid of the scene. She didn't know she didn't consider herself a singer. She wanted to rehearse the scene, and every day she would go to John and say, "John, can we rehearse that scene? Can I do the song for you? I need to know how I'm supposed to move." And he'd say, "Don't worry, Claire. We have plenty of time. We won't shoot that for another few weeks. Don't worry." And then one day, John said, "Okay, we're going to do the song now." And Claire was mortified. "How can we do this? I've never rehearsed it." And John said, "Don't worry, Claire. Just get up and sing." And that's the performance she gave. And he wanted her to be rotten. He wanted her to be nervous. He wanted her to be the alcoholic ex-singer who was down and out on her luck. And he got that performance. And off to the side, a few of the actors, including Harry Lewis, who was one of the bad guys in the movie, whispered, "You know, she's going to win the Academy Award because of that." And sure enough, she did.
Yeah, he wanted her to be really unprepared.
Yes. I mean, when John saw or, you know, knew the kind of character he wanted, he didn't necessarily want to over-prepare an actor or to even talk to him. He liked to keep them on the edge. And he did that time and time again, and I think it really worked effectively in a number of his films.
Let me ask you about one of his most famous films, which is The African Queen. There is, I believe, a whole book written about the making of that movie. Well, the film, The African Queen, was shot on location.
Right.
And there were a lot of problems they ran into shooting on location.
There were enormous problems. John went hunting one day with Katharine Hepburn, and they were charged by elephants. A wild boar almost got her. There were ants that attacked them, and they had to keep their beds and the bedposts and all and legs in kerosene, so they couldn't go up on the bed. They finally had to move locations, set fire to areas. The African Queen itself sunk. But there were enormous problems continuously, but everybody was on edge about it, and people got dysentery. Katharine Hepburn got very sick for over a week. But John, you know, drank his booze with Bogey. He never drank the water, and had a ball. That was really the first of the jet set, directors, John, going to Africa in 1950-51 to make the film instead of being on a studio lot.
Yeah, Houston told you that this is one of the few movies he'd enjoy reliving. Given all the disasters that happened, it's hard to imagine what made him have such a great time.
Well, that was John's element. I mean, if he could, the further away he could get from civilization, the more difficult the area that they could shoot in. I mean, he even discovered that river by going over in a plane, the River Ruiki, and he dropped a handkerchief from the plane and said, "That's where we'll shoot." And one of his crew members actually found that handkerchief. So, I mean, you know, it was fascinating with John, but did the same thing with A Man Who Would Be King. If he could find strange locations, if he could go to Tobago to shoot Heaven Knows Mr. Allison, he'd go there. You know, he didn't like to shoot movies on lots. Night of the Iguana, Ms. Maloya Beach, Puerto Vallarta, he really discovered that place.
John Huston has been praised for the way his movies have been cast, but there's one movie in particular in which the casting was really called into question, and I'm referring to Gregory Peck, who starred as Captain Ahab in the 56 film version of
Moby Dick.
Yeah,
it came out in 56, right.
Yeah, let me play an excerpt from this movie.
"All you mastheaders, now hear me. You're to look for the white whale. A whale as white and as big as a mountain of snow. Aye, like corkscrews. He's struck full of harpoons, man. And his spout is a big one, like a whole shock of wheat. And he fan tails like a broken jib in a storm. Death, men, you've seen him. It's Moby Dick."
"Captain Ahab, was it not Moby Dick took off thy leg?"
"Aye. It was Moby Dick that tore my soul and body until they bled into each other."
Why was Gregory Peck so criticized in that role, and why did John Huston defend his choice?
Well, Peck was criticized because they said he looked like Abraham Lincoln. He didn't look obsessed enough or crazed enough. And a lot of people, especially all the crew members, thought that the real person who should have played Captain Ahab was John, because John, you know, behaved very much like Ahab during the making of this. But John defended Peck all the time. He thought he was cast right. He said he seldom looked at his movies a second time, but he did see Moby Dick again on television, and he told me that he was unbudged regarding Peck's performance. He said there was a kind of massive dignity that he had, and the speech that he gives to Starbuck where he goes, "It's a vile, vile day." He said, "My God, the voice is just right." Where John Foltz, the film more, was seeing the ending of Moby Dick, and then having seen Jaws, Steven Spielberg's film, he saw how magnificent and how the way the shark was done and the teeth on Jaws and everything. And he said, "I didn't have enough teeth in my whale. I didn't have enough movement." And I said to John, "The technology didn't exist then to do what you wanted to do." And he said, "That's not the point." He says, "I should have invented it, you know. And if he could have had another shot at some of his films, he'd like to have redone the ending of Moby Dick and make it more powerful."
Lawrence Grobel is my guest, and his new book, The Houstons, is a family biography. Let's jump ahead a little bit and talk about how John Huston started working with his daughter, the actress Angelica Huston. And two of her most acclaimed performances were in films directed by her father, Pritzi's Honor and The Dead. But the first time they worked together was a film that very few people have seen, I think. Mm-hmm. A film called A Walk with Love and Death that came out in, I think it was 1969.
Right.
Now, how did they first work together in this film?
Well, she was 15 years old. She had just read for Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet, and she was one of three contenders to be in that, and she really wanted to do that. But John felt he hadn't really been close with either of his children. He grew up a bit distance from them. He was never around during their growing up, and he wanted to do something.
Well, he was long divorced from Angelica's mother, right?
He wasn't divorced. They were separated.
Oh,
they
okay.
never divorced. But he finally got her. He told her he's going to do A Walk with Love and Death. Ricky, her mother, was against it because she had to go out of school to do it. And right before they were going to shoot it, Angelica cut her hair short. Now, she's playing a 14th century maiden, and she's supposed to have long hair, and they had to go get some props from the Bible to some wigs for her. And John never could understand that behavior. He couldn't understand why she was crying all the time. He couldn't understand why if Katharine Hepburn could take direction from him, his own daughter wouldn't. And it was just a difficult time, and she was very unhappy throughout it. But the film came out, and then her mother died, and then she has to go to the States and start promoting it. It was a very difficult time for her, and she didn't want to act after that for a long time. She became a model. She then started doing some small parts in movies after meeting Nicholson and being with him in 72 and 73. And it wasn't until really Pritzi's Honor, 1985, which came out, they shot it in 84, that she came into her own, she realized she had a reconciliation with her father. She realized that the best way for them to get along was for them to work together. And she really pulled that one off and, of course, won the Oscar. And then she did The Dead, which Tony, his son, wrote and got a nomination for writing it. I think that solidified Angelica as the next Huston down the line with those two performances.
You haven't gotten back in touch with Angelica Huston and spoken to her about a performance in Woody Allen's new film, have you?
Yes, actually, I did. I spoke with Angelica about a week and a half ago before she went off to do The Grifters, this latest film she's in. And I hadn't yet seen it. I have since. But I told her, I've been reading about it. I said, "Boy, you certainly have you're getting a lot of good notices about this." And she says, "Well, it's definitely a one-note movie," she says, "for me. It's a lot of shrieking and a lot of yelling and a lot of harping at his character." And she, of course, ends up getting killed in this movie of Woody Allen's, which is a departure for him as well. But she was very pleased with it. She really wanted to work with Woody Allen, and she felt it was a major thing in her life to have done that.
John Huston was known as quite a womanizer, and he had affairs with many women in Hollywood and many women who worked on his movies. How did that affect his reputation in Hollywood?
Well, things weren't blasted the way they are today in the tabloids, and you could have a life that was a bit wild, and it wasn't always out there. But he did. John was so wild at times that he went out with John Houseman's wife, Zita Johann. They were, and he was drunk and got into a car accident. She went through the windshield in 1932. In 1933, he was with he ran over a woman and had a big problem there and had to leave the country. So I was very fortunate that I was able to talk to many of these people, the mistresses, the three living wives, the people who called him the most prolific man sexually they ever met. There was no one like him except perhaps Lucifer. These are the kind of remarks you got. And yet they all talked about him, and they all had stories about him, and he was a central figure in many of their lives. So he was quite a man.
John Huston was very productive at the end of his life and made several movies that he'll probably always be remembered for: The Dead, Pritzi's Honor, Wise Blood.
Under the Volcano, right?
Were you able to talk to him about why he seemed to be so driven toward the end of his life at an age when most directors have long retired?
Well, John never believed in a hereafter. It was only one life, and that was the life you live. And he believed that he always said, if I'm bored, I run from boredom like a hare. So I think that John just did what he could do, and if he could make movies, he would make them right up until the end, which of course is what he did.
I want to ask you about Chinatown, in which John Huston had a small role. It's a wonderful performance, and in this movie directed by Roman Polanski. Huston plays someone who we find out at the end of the movie has had an incestuous relationship with his daughter and then ends up having custody over her. And it's a really scary, chilling role. How did he get the role and how did he feel about taking it?
Well, Roman Polanski, I saw him in Paris as well, and I talked to him, and he said he always had John Huston in mind for this part. He says, you know, he says, I know that kind of guy. He's a kind of a cowboy. He's a womanizer. He's a all powerful kind of character. And he says, he's a bit of a bastard as well. And John, it seemed to me that everything he had read about John Huston was who he was. So he went to convince John about doing it. And of course, John, you know, John never took acting that seriously. He always said there was one actor in my family, and that was Walter. And of course, I think he would at the end say Angelica as well. But he did a lot of those things for the money. He was always in debt and gambling and whatever. And because he was very generous with his life, he always was spending money. So acting was a way of making money when he wasn't directing a film. When this part came along and he got to do it with Nicholson, be with Nicholson and watch Polanski, it was interesting to him. And he played that very chillingly. And it's a marvelous part. I think he holds up. I think he steals the scenes whenever he is in with Nicholson. And it's quite a tribute to him to be able to have done that.
Lawrence Grobel, thanks a lot for talking with us about the Hustons.
Well, thank you very much.